FA distribution sites. The organization said over 500 Palestinians have been killed while seeking aid since the GHF started operating in late May, following Israel's three-month blockade of Gaza. Almost 4,000 people have been injured.
Good afternoon. You are tuned into Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. My name is Daniel Del Piélago, and as always, thank you so much for tuning in, for joining us here every Tuesday afternoon to get caught up on around what's going on in the city. This afternoon, we are going to be discussing a specific part of the city budget as it relates to healthcare. We are glad and honored to have Mark Lavoda join us. Mark is the executive director of the District of Columbia Behavioral Health Association. That's a mouthful. And he's going to help us to understand, you know, what we're seeing so far in the budget as it relates to healthcare and, you know, health related programs that many people in the district depend on. So with that said, let me remind folks, just in case, this is a pre-recorded show. We will not be able to take phone calls this afternoon, but know that this is fresh information just the day before. This is being recorded just the day before the show airs. So once again, thank you so much, Mark, for joining us. Thank you for making the time. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, around your organization, before we get started?
Sure. Thanks, Daniel. Glad to be here and appreciate the listeners taking the time to listen about these important issues. The District of Columbia Behavioral Health Association is a trade association for organizations that provide mental health and substance use services for district residents who have a mental illness, a substance use disorder, or both. We have about 35 member organizations that serve about 35,000 district residents annually. Almost all of them are Medicaid beneficiaries, so we spend a lot of time thinking about the Medicaid program. And we do the kinds of things that trade associations do. So we do policy advocacy, we do training and technical assistance for our members, we do community engagement, and we connect our members to the resources of the National Council for Mental Well-being, because we know that there are important issues where they can learn from their colleagues across the country, and important ways that it's helpful to be plugged in to people who are doing national policy work or national training and technical assistance activities. I've been in this role for 9 years now, and before that I spent 11 years with Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Washington. So I've been thinking about and engaging in healthcare in the district for a couple decades now.
Wow. Yeah. I was looking at your profile. You're going on 10 years there with your organization. So congratulations on that and for all of your good work. Mark, you are the chair also of the Health Justice Working Group with with the Fair Budget Coalition, who annually advocates for, you know, funding for many of the safety net kind of programs that help many district residents. And I've been part of that, and I've seen you, you know, in that, and that's not easy work. Of course, every year There are many priorities in the budget, and we'll be discussing some of those this afternoon. And just before we get started on that, just to give folks a little background on the budget process, because we've done it before, but I like to kind of set us a starting point. The mayor, if I'm not mistaken, towards the end of May, released her budget, which was late. Then shortly, almost literally the day after, the city council, it's presented to the city council. The city council started their hearings that they have every year around listening to district residents around, you know, what should be funded, what's going well, and what's not going well, with the different programs that the different agencies in the District of Columbia administer. So right now we are in the process where the specific committees in the council have pretty much finished up their recommendations, and it's, you know, we're nearing kind of the end of the budget cycle. Shortly there will be a first vote on the budget, and that'll pretty much be it on how the budget will look for this coming year. Although there may be some slight changes, and there's a second vote, then it's got to go to the federal government for approval. And it's a mess. And we'll talk a little bit about the federal budget too, if that's okay. But I just wanted to give folks that understanding of the process. It's been a little rushed. And unfortunately, what many folks are saying, especially who do this work that serve low-income district residents who need services and resources, is that there are many cuts that are happening, and there is, not a lot of funding for some critical services. Through the lens of the fair budget and just in general the work that you do, can you talk to us about what are some of the concerns in general? What were the things that you were looking to get funded to ensure that district residents are getting the resources that they need?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel. So one of the things that we think about within the Fair Budget Coalition is the need to make sure that we're addressing whole person needs. The people have needs that are in healthcare, what we call above the neck and below the neck needs, they may have mental health issues, they may have substance use challenges, and they also have risk with diabetes or heart disease or things like that. So we need whole person physical and mental health care. We recognize that people need access to services and resources. They need safety, they need a good place to live, they need nutritious food. And one of the things that sometimes we see is that we get asked to advocate for something specific as if it's in opposition to making sure that resources are available to address those other needs. And one of the reasons that Fair Budget Coalition comes together is to reject that premise. We want to say consistently, don't pit us against each other. We know that if you take away one of those resources, then people have greater needs in all of those other areas because their lives become less stable and they need additional support from some other part of the system. So we really need a well-running city, and we need the comprehensive resources that address the kind of multiplicity of the challenges that life brings to people in the city. In the health justice issue group, we also make sure that we are attentive not just to traditional kind of healthcare like you might get in a doctor's office or some other clinic, but also thinking about making sure that the environment is the kind of environment that we need in the community. We know that people get asthma because there's mold in their homes. We know that people have learning disabilities because there's lead paint. And so we try to make sure that we're addressing environmental issues. And we try to make sure that we're sensitive to the needs of people with disabilities. And again, treating people as whole people, even if someone has what's diagnosed as a disability, we want to make sure that they can participate in community life and live as full and rich of a life as any of our other neighbors.
That's right. No, thank you for that. As I mentioned, and unfortunately that is the issue, because people start saying, well, we need housing and we need food and we need. So thank you for underscoring that point that, you know, people aren't single issued, right? People, just because they have a full belly doesn't mean that they don't need a place to live or healthcare or any other of those services. So unfortunately, this budget has created that sense that there's such, you know, little money that we have to, you know, make these tough choices and cut certain things. You know, what is of concern as you've been looking at the budget? What has concerned you aside from obviously the big picture, right? Because there are cuts across the board, unfortunately. But as it relates to healthcare, you know, there are some significant issues happening, and I think you're better prepared to talk about those than I am. So I'll just set you up to please share with us what are some of those more specific concerns around healthcare that district residents may lose access to.
Yeah, well, sadly, there are two pieces to it. One, people are going to lose things that they already have. And then two, we also didn't make progress in some of the areas that we hoped we'd be able to make some progress. So I'll talk about the latter part first, because it's a little easier just to say we had hoped that we'd be able to do new things next year, like empower building inspectors to become mold inspectors, because we know that they already go into people's homes. And when they're doing those inspections, they often see signs of mold. But since they don't have the training, they're not allowed to actually issue an official mold remediation requirement for that building. And so we had said, well, why don't we just train these folks to be mold inspectors so that when they go out and do their inspections, they don't have to call somebody else and hope that they can schedule a second appointment that eventually might get the resources and help people address the mold that's in their homes. We didn't get that. And we've been asking for that for several years. We saw the mayor not provide investments in replacing lead service lines. And we had really hoped that we would be in a place where we could see more progress being made to replace the lines for drinking water and help prevent young children from being exposed and poisoned by lead. So those are things that we didn't get that we had hoped that we would get. We also, and this is kind of where we start to get to the bigger set of challenges, we saw proposals that will really scale back how many people are eligible for Medicaid, how many people are eligible for the DC Healthcare Alliance, and some of those folks will get assigned to a different kind of insurance plan that's being newly developed by the DC Health Benefit Exchange. So they won't lose everything, and that's a relief. But at the same time, their benefit will be more limited than what they've been used to getting if they were on Medicaid. So they won't necessarily have dental care included in their insurance anymore. They won't have vision care included in their insurance. If they're receiving care from a DBH certified provider for their mental health conditions, they might not be able to stay part of an assertive community treatment team or receive rehabilitation day services. They'll still be able to go to an outpatient clinic and have a conversation with a therapist. They'll still be able to go to a psychiatrist and get their medication managed, but they're going to lose some of the more intensive services that help them to be stable in the community and to not need higher levels of care. So those are concerns that we're seeing. And this is not just a few people. The reduction in Medicaid eligibility is expected to affect 25,500 people. The reduction in Alliance will be capped at 28,000 individuals. And then gradually, as people don't renew their Alliance, no one new will be added to the Alliance. At least no new adults. The Immigrant Children Program is also going away, and instead there will be a new children's benefit in the Alliance. So people are going to have to watch very carefully as paperwork comes to see, what am I being asked to do? Do I need to take action now, or is this just information to help me understand what's coming next? If I have to fill out different paperwork, what does that mean? Am I still going to have access to my doctor? Am I still going to have access to my therapist? Am I still going to have access to my dentist? And am I going to be with the same insurance company, or did I get assigned to a different insurance company as part of this process too? So there are a lot of things that all of us in the healthcare community are going to be trying to communicate to the community about keeping in touch and feeling free to ask your provider, hey, can you help me understand what's going on? Can you tell me if my insurance is still good here? Can you make sure that I understand where else I might be able to get help since I know that I can't get help anymore the way that I used to? So those are big changes that we're seeing. I'll just name a couple other things, but I hope we can come back to that because I think there's a lot to unpack.
Yes, please.
We also saw school behavioral health funding flat funded. And so we're not going to make it into every DC public and public charter school with the clinicians that we had hoped that we would be able to get into every school. But the council did do a good thing. They've raised the grant amounts. So CBOs that already have clinicians placed are more likely to be able to retain their clinicians. And there will be a couple more schools that they'll be able to match with successfully that they weren't able to in the past year or two. So, it's a work in progress, but we didn't expand as far as we had hoped we would be able to. And then for the organizations that I represent and for the people that they serve, there's also a major administrative change that the Department of Behavioral Health has proposed. To implement their budget, they're seeing about $11.3 million reduction in their provider payment allowance. And the way that they are going to make that work is by cutting people's care hours in half. And so someone who might have been used to seeing a caseworker once a week is now going to see their caseworker twice a month. Someone who might have been used to receiving 2 hours of care a week will only get an hour a week. And so, for some people, that means that it's going to be harder for the DBH certified providers to give them the support that they need for doing things like going to the Social Security office when the online system doesn't work, or accompanying them to a physical healthcare appointment because we want to be sure that their physician is helping them manage the side effects of their psychiatric medication. And so things like that are going to be disrupted. And we are really concerned that while we know this is an environment where the district has to use its resources efficiently, we think there are other ways that the Department of Behavioral Health could have saved the same amount of money and gotten better results.
Wow, no, thank you for all of that, Mark. As you were speaking, it just makes me think. I recently had to have, just out of the blue, maybe I'm oversharing here, but it's just making me think of this. Out of the blue, I got a detached retina. My retina detached in my right eye, and I had to have emergency surgery. I'm blessed to have insurance, but it's been quite a journey just to manage that, right? And once again, I am blessed to have an insurance that for the most part has covered all of these issues. So I'm just trying to put myself, as you are speaking, just thinking about the many district residents who, don't have the so-called market insurance and just may not have the wherewithal to navigate these huge changes that are coming, with the other issue that, life happens, right? Things happen. And if we are seeing these kind of cuts across the board, people's health is really in danger, right? As you do not get the same service and care that you once depended on, a lot of things can change. So just really, really disappointed right now that so many of our neighbors are going to have to deal with this and obviously make some very tough decisions. You mentioned, let's go back to the unfortunate folks, the cuts, unfortunate cuts that are going to happen to folks, you know, who depend on the DC Healthcare Alliance and Medicaid. If you would unpack that a little bit more, like who is that affecting? And once again, you know, through your experience, you know, what kind of a real life effect will that have on folks?
Right. So let's talk about Medicaid first. There are 25,500 people who the Department of Healthcare Finance has identified that have incomes above 133% of federal poverty. And I don't have that number in front of me right now. I think it's about $17,000. That's the starting threshold there. Up to between 210 and 214% of federal poverty. So there's that window there that currently are covered under Medicaid, and these are single childless adults, as well as parents or caregivers of child Medicaid beneficiaries. That's the two sets of adults that we're talking about. What we're expecting to see is that almost all of those individuals will be eligible for a different health plan that will be administered through the health benefit exchange. And in many cases, it will be the same insurance company that they have now, but not always. So what does that look like? Well, the health benefit exchange is telling us that they can use a different federal funding stream that's not Medicaid money, but instead has to do with some premium subsidies that are offered to people who have low incomes trying to purchase care through the marketplace. And the district government can bundle those together and offer to an insurance carrier to say, can you please cover these services? And what the district is proposing to do in this case is to make those services available so that they don't require people to pay any out-of-pocket premium and so that they won't have any co-pays or deductibles. So all of that's really good news because we know that part of the purpose of insurance is preventing financial crisis for people, right? And so we're helping to avoid some of the financial challenges that come with participating in insurance. We're expecting that this is going to be the same kinds of companies that people have been used to receiving their insurance coverage from in Medicaid. So that's if you're part of AmeriHealth or if you're part of AmeriGroup or if you're part of MedStar Family Choice. The district is also allowing other what are called health maintenance organizations that people may be familiar with to participate. So you may see an offering from Blue Cross, you may see an offering from Kaiser Permanente. But one of those five groups is the most likely that we'll see to be offering this product. And so people then will get what are called, quote unquote, essential health benefits. These are defined in the 2010 Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. And that says, if you have an insurance plan at all, it has to include these things. And that includes a set of primary care services, a set of hospital services, some mental health and substance use services, some other specialty services. And so people will get that coverage, and it'll look a lot the same as what they're getting in Medicaid, unless they need one of the things that's not covered anymore. And so that's where we start to see changes. Dental care is not an essential health benefit. Vision care is not an essential health benefit unless you have an eye infection. But just getting your glasses adjusted, getting new contact lenses, going in and making sure that you know whether or not you can see near vision and far vision, those tests from an optometrist are not covered. There also is not coverage, like I mentioned earlier, for some of the more intensive care that people might need from a rehabilitation behavioral health perspective. So if someone needed not just psychotherapy or a psychiatrist, but they also needed community support or assertive community treatment or day rehabilitation services, they wouldn't be able to get those enhanced services On the substance use side, they wouldn't get rehabilitation recovery support services or environmental stability services. So it could mean that people feel like they're not getting the kind of wraparound support that they've been used to. People will also lose access to things like case management for permanent supportive housing, which could be really disruptive for people whose vouchers require case management. And so we're still going to have to figure out kind of how else that is being provided, just to make sure that people don't lose eligibility for their housing vouchers as well. So it's a big set of changes for the Medicaid population. Maybe before I talk about Alliance, I'll just give you a chance to see if there's anything else you would want me to say about Medicaid.
No, thank you for covering that so thoroughly. And I think the WPFW audience appreciates that, right? Because as you mentioned, you know, there's going to be a lot of changes that are going to happen, and folks are going to have to adapt. And just once again, no, thank you for pointing those out. And, you know, perhaps a little later, we'll talk about, you know, how folks can stay in touch and find out these changes. So no, thank you so much for covering that so thoroughly.
Great. So let me just talk a little bit about Alliance. And I have to say, there's not as much detail available yet about exactly what is changing with the Alliance. So we're going to have to wait beyond the budget. We've seen what's being proposed in terms of how much money is available, but the actual policies.
And sorry, just if you could just define, just in case folks may not know, what the DC Healthcare Alliance is.
That's right. So the DC Healthcare Alliance is an alternative coverage program that offers a limited set of healthcare services to people who meet the income criteria for Medicaid, but for some other reason are not eligible for Medicaid. And so in some cases, we see that that's true for people who are in some kind of immigration status, because there are rules about people needing to be in the country for a certain number of years with a certain kind of federal approval before they can access Medicaid services. In some cases, there are people who have returned from certain kinds of incarceration status. Sometimes if you have certain federal charges, or if you are released to the community, but you're not fully out of custody yet, then you're also not eligible for Medicaid. And so the Alliance is really a program that's trying to help people navigate through those gaps in our other safety net health insurance programs. Like I said, it's not as comprehensive as what you would get in a typical insurance plan. That's true either for Medicaid or for the commercial market. They don't have to include the essential health benefits or things like that. But the Alliance does offer coverage for primary care, for dental care, for certain kinds of hospitalizations that are necessary. And so it's, again, it's the making sure that people have access to care, and also making sure that it doesn't become financially crippling if they do need to seek more specialized healthcare services. So that's a broad and kind of general description of the Alliance.
Well, thank you for that. And as you mentioned, that's going to affect a subset of people who already have a lot of kind of issues to deal with. So potentially one more thing to worry about. Folks, you are tuned into Taking Action here on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C. We are having a conversation with Mark Lavoda, who is the executive director of, let me make sure I say this right, because I almost butchered it when we introduced him. He is the executive director of the, where are my notes? Of the District of Columbia Behavioral Health Association. He also serves as the chair of the Health Justice Working Group for the Fair Budget Coalition. And we've been discussing some of the challenges that we are facing in the fiscal year 26 budget that the city council is currently working on finalizing. As we explained, the mayor submitted her budget. The city council is doing what they do with the budget, and shortly we will have a much better idea of where all of this will land, as I believe the first vote on the district's budget for the coming year, for the FY26 budget, is on the 14th. I know a lot of folks, Mark, turned out, you know, in the process of speaking to the council, of kind of highlighting their priorities, and hopefully that's had some impact. You know, what do you see as next steps now? Like, what do we need to prepare for? You know, what you had mentioned earlier, folks simply, you know, one big thing is folks need to know that there are changes that will likely come and should be, you know, asking about that. But more big picture, you know, what is this saying about our city when there's so many, you know, flat funding, as you mentioned, reduction in funding, projects that we felt were important, you know, not being funded? You know, I work around a lot of housing issues, and having, you know, the city's inspectors being able to inspect for mold and to be able to do that is so important when that is such a pervasive issue in so much of the city's housing stock, you know, the older, especially our older housing stock. So now we are at this point where we are kind of bracing for something that is not great. I just saw the Fair Budget Coalition has released its report card, and you know, around the budget, and it's not great. So, you know, where do we go from here? What should folks expect?
Yeah, so the budget process really is not over. And so as much as we know what each of the committees of the council has done, to a certain extent, the next couple of weeks are even more critical, because this is when people kind of see, okay, could the committees fix things that looked like they were going to be really bad for residents? Could the committees come up with new proposals about things that the mayor might not have considered that needed attention? What happened in that process? On Wednesday morning, the whole council will get together for a full day work session to talk about what's come out of the budget so far, and to allow council members to share what they are thinking about as their key priorities before they wrap up their voting on the budget. And so one of the things that people can do is tune in and see what their council members are saying about these things, and see what the whole council is saying about these things. And if they don't like what they hear, then they can reach out to the council. And, you know, there are tons of ways to do that. Even if people didn't have a chance to testify during the formal committee hearing process, council members have staff who pick up the phone. They will listen to you when you call. They will take a voicemail and take notes on what you have to say. They all have email addresses that are published on the DC Council website. You can send a note and say, I'm really concerned about this thing. Could you pay more attention to this, because it matters to my family and my community? Or, you know, you can go ahead and tax me more. I'm going to be okay, even though I'm worried that some of my neighbors are not. So, you know, there is that portion of all of us kind of trying to figure out together, how do we help the council to live up to the aspirations of the community, and to respect that they're trying to do that in a very hard time. The chief financial officer has projected that the district is losing $1 billion worth of revenue over the next 3 years because of all of the federal government layoffs and the reductions in people spending time downtown. And so, you know, this is a hard budget year, and we want to be respectful of people needing to make hard decisions, but we elected them to make hard decisions, and we elected them to make hard decisions on behalf of the people of the District of Columbia. And so that's what we need to continue to expect of them, and to push them to improve their choices.
No, thank you for pointing that out. And it really it is a year-round process, right? Like it never stops. There are these kind of finite dates that happen, but you're 100% right that people should be lifting up their voices and their priorities until those those dates happen. So thank you for underscoring that as well. You mentioned around the federal stuff, and I think just over the weekend there was some a lot of talk around the federal budget and some of the things that are happening with that. I don't want to put you on the spot because I realize you focus a lot on the district issues around healthcare, but any concerns or any takeaways you may have around what's happening with the federal budget and how that could, even more adversely affect district residents.
Right. Well, you shared with everyone that we are taping this ahead of Tuesday. And so
That's
by the
right.
time our listeners are listening, there may be changes from what we know right now. Over the weekend, the Senate had a very contentious debate, as the Senate is structured to do, over some of the proposed cuts to Medicaid. And there are members of the Senate and of both parties, I will note, that have major concerns about what's been proposed so far about changes to Medicaid. Some of those may have changed by the time your listeners are hearing this program. So I can't say for sure. I can say if those changes move forward, they include things like work requirements or community engagement requirements that would involve a lot of paperwork for Medicaid beneficiaries. Even though there's pretty good reason to believe that most people who are capable of working that are receiving Medicaid are already working, or that people are disabled, or they are caregivers and they have other roles that they may not be earning an income, but they are trying to take care of themselves and their families as best they can. And so those are not the people that you would want to lose Medicaid coverage either. But there's a threat that administratively more people will lose their Medicaid coverage. There's also been a lot of discussion over the weekend about so-called provider taxes. And some parts of the Medicaid program are specially designed to tax healthcare providers and then reinvest those taxes back into those providers' payments matched by federal Medicaid dollars. And so in the district, that applies to our hospitals, that applies to our nursing care facilities. And there's a limited piece that also applies to services for people with intellectual or developmental disabilities. If the things that were proposed as of this weekend are moving forward, then the district's hospitals are going to be in really rough shape. And we might even see a hospital close. And that's just kind of a shocking level of change to come out of a federal tax bill. So there are some real concerns about what could happen, and the district government is then going to have to adjust its own operations further if they want to offset any of those federal changes. And so I do think that there's a possibility that we will see that everything that's just come out of the committee markup and even whatever comes out of the first vote may not be the final vote on the FY26 budget because either the council is going to have to do its own revisions if we see federal movement quickly, or in the fall, the mayor is going to have to come back with a supplemental budget, and the council is going to have to negotiate with the mayor how to spend an even smaller pie. And that's really what it's coming down to is, we talk about how we distribute the pie, but we also know that if the pie itself is shrinking, then people are going to get less.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, I saw some startling number as I was doing a little research that nearly 17 million Americans of this, you know, this federal budget package goes through, could lose health coverage. Of course, you know, so those could be district residents. So very, very, very alarming, you know, in my, I would say, you know, I've done this work maybe 10, 15 years. And, you know, I don't know, this does appear to be one of the worst budget cycles that we've had. And as you mentioned, you know, it's tough, right? There are, you know, there's a lot of issues at play. It is tough to make these decisions around what gets funded, what doesn't, what gets cut. But ultimately, I think what, you know, what the folks we work with are asking is what happens to me then, right? Like, what if I can't pay my rent? What if I can't afford to buy groceries? What if I can't afford to take my kids to the doctor? And I think those are the very real questions that our local elected officials are going to have to wrestle with, because what we're going to see is, unfortunately, a host of folks suffering from, as we started the show, you very acutely pointed out, you know, folks aren't single issued, right? They're not affected by only one thing. It's across the board that we're seeing these things. And I think, you know, many folks want to see a city that prioritizes its people and their well-being over, you know, we can get into the whole stadium thing and all of these other kind of priorities that we've seen that the city, that the mayor has put forth. But ultimately, what I think many folks are saying is we need to brace for a lot of suffering that is ahead, unfortunately. So, Mark, I just want to thank you so much for pointing out some of these issues as it relates to healthcare, to health issues. You know, I'm concerned, as somebody who's also worked around some school issues, that, you know, around behavioral health, that our young people may not receive the same services that they've had in the past. I know how important that is, especially as we try to wrestle in the city around youth violence. And, you know, we keep hearing that as an issue, but, you know, we need to invest in the things that will help young people, you know, better deal with some of the very real life issues that are all a result of, unfortunately, sometimes living in poverty and not having access to resources. You know, as we wrap up here, I wanted to see if, you know, in general, you know, if you have any kind of major takeaways and anything to share with our audience as we move through these tough times.
Yeah, you know, I think that what part of what I just said about people can still reach out, that there is still time left, is really important. I appreciate you talking about the youth behavioral health issues and making sure that we're trying to figure out how to take care of our kids. Unfortunately, it just reminds me of another one of these things that we saw the mayor cut funding for. CHAMPS, the youth mobile crisis services, was slashed. And so, you know, we're going to be in a place where not only are there fewer resources maybe in schools, but the schools are not going to have the partnership that they have relied on with mobile crisis teams to come out if there is a youth mental health crisis happening. And so, you know, we really are going to have to push the government to make the best of the resources that they do have available, and come up with different plans if the things that they funded in the past that got cut are no longer there. And so, you know, there is the kind of budget process, and then there's also implementation that we're going to have to rely on the mayor and her team, including agency directors and including frontline staff, to figure out how to make the best use of whatever resources do end up being allocated. And I would encourage people also to be involved in those discussions. Figure out how to come join a meeting of the Behavioral Health Planning Council or the School Behavioral Health Coordinating Council or the Interagency Council on Homelessness or the Medicaid Medical Care Advisory Committee. there are all of these different other ways to provide input to the executive about how they can use the resources that they have more effectively. And we need to keep talking to them about how they can do that. The mayor and her team are trying to make the best decisions that they can make. And my experience working with them is that they want to see district residents thrive. And I might not always share the same approach as the ways that they try to propose to approach those things. But I think that they're committed to listening. And I think that they do change their behavior when they hear from enough people that what they're doing isn't working. And so that's the rest of my encouragement is, the budget process is one part of the process, but government is a year-round exercise and civic participation in government is a year-round opportunity.
Oh, that's exactly right. And, we would hate for this to set kind of the tone for the out years, because many, during this process, we are looking at this kind of immediate thing, right? The next year fiscal budget. But, and this is overly used, I think, sometimes, but I still think it rings true is, the budgets are a reflection of the values of a city, right? What do they value and what do they want to fund? And we want to make sure that this city is investing in its residents, especially its most neediest residents. As you mentioned a little earlier, you said, tax me more. So that money can go and help, my neighbors, our neighbors. And that's something that I think we've not seen in this budget is a lot of ideas to raise revenues. So we can do more with what we're able to collect from those who have, there's a lot of wealthy people in the city, and at the very least, folks that who want to help. Thank you for pointing that out. Once again, thank you so much for all your work and for giving us a really clear understanding of what's at stake here and what folks need to keep an eye out for. We'll be providing updates as we move forward, as this part of the budget season wraps up. As we mentioned, folks, this was a pre-recorded show, with some stipulations that things might change, especially as we see the federal government change. So make sure to keep tuned, here to WPFW. I know we'll have updates on all of this through all of the rich programming that we offer here. But want to thank Mark so much once again for making the time to join us and to educate us on what's happening with the health related issues with the FY26 budget. Thank you so much, Mark.
Well, thanks again, Daniel, and thanks to all of your listeners for their interest.
Well, and folks, we will catch you next Tuesday. Once again, thank you so much for your listenership, for your support. We will catch you next Tuesday. Peace, everyone.
The WPFW Local Station Board's Relocation Committee is in the process of re-envisioning what studio space for a progressive, community-based, and community-supported radio station should be in the coming decade or more. We wish to ensure that a new, more permanent home will meet current needs and those less foreseeable in the future. All WPFW stakeholders, listeners, donors, programmers, staff, community activists may share their thoughts and insights about the future space by taking the location survey located on the WPFW homepage. Be creative in your answers. The future belongs to those who dream big. The survey may be found at www.wpfwfm.org. Please submit your answers by June 30th. Thank you for your thoughts and time.
The Birchmere presents Omar, July 17th. Hubert Laws, July 20th. Hiroshima, July 24th. And Sheila E., July 30th. Details at thebirchmere.com.
To get WPFW swag in your life? Items that say, I support jazz and justice without saying a word. We've got you covered. Details and browsing at WPFWFM.org. Again, that's WPFWFM.org.
While Medgar Evers and Patrice Lumumba were not personally acquainted, their lives and struggles are often commemorated together due to the parallels in their commitment to fighting for the self-determination and liberation of African people. WPFW celebrates the centennial of this parallel vision with From Mississippi to the Congo, 100 Years of Lumumba and Medgar, Wednesday, July 2nd, noon until midnight on WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This July 4th, WPFW presents Higher, the poetic genius of Sekou Sundiata and the musical innovation of Sly Stone. From 9 a.m. until 7 p.m., we begin at 11 a.m. with an airing of Sekou Sundiata's 51st Dream State, a multimedia meditation on empire. At 1 p.m., our multifaceted exploration of Sly Stone kicks off until 7 p.m. with tributes curated by Brother Jamil, James Funk, and DJ Lance Reynolds. Full schedule at WPFWFM.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Still, it's a real good bet, the best is yet to come.
Hi, this is Robin Holden, the proprietor of Robin's Place. Every Friday evening from 7 until 10 p.m., Robin's Place is a mythical entertainment center consisting of four floors. On each floor of Robin's Place, we have rooms that are named after people who I think are icons in music, theater, and literature. We have the Nancy Wilson Room, the Joe Williams Room, the Gloria Lynn Room, the Frank Sinatra Room, the B.B. King Blues Room, the James Baldwin Library, just to name a few. Join me Friday nights from 7 until 10 p.m. as I take you on a musical journey you'll never forget. Robin's Place.
Come the day you're
mine. The Youth Resiliency Institute's annual Cherry Hill Arts and Music Waterfront Festival is back on Friday, July 4th, 1 until 10 p.m. at Middle Branch Park in Baltimore. Music, food trucks, children's activities, vendors, art exhibition, and more in celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Youth Resiliency Institute. Performers include Navasha Dea, Cecily, DJ Grin, and Fusion Orchestra, and more. Details at cherryhillfest.com or 443-813-2116. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
talk show Africa Now airs Wednesdays at 1 p.m. It's a modern view on historical issues concerning the entire African world, addressing how African people are participating in globalization, ways in which the rest of the world continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Good afternoon. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Here are some headlines for this hour. Following the Votorama, or marathon voting session, that began yesterday, Senate Republicans narrowly passed President Trump's self-proclaimed Big Beautiful Bill this morning. The vote was 51-50, with Vice President J.D. Vance breaking the tie. Three Republicans broke ranks and voted against the bill: Susan Collins of Maine, Tom Tillis of North Carolina, and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Trump's bill, which he says is essential to his agenda of making America great again, would permanently extend his 2017 tax cuts. Republicans intend to offset some of those costs with cuts to programs that many Americans rely on, namely the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, along with major changes to Medicaid, which provides health care for roughly 70 million low-income, elderly, and disabled Americans. Early estimates suggest that around 11 million people could lose coverage under this newly passed bill. Today, President Trump visited Alligator Alcatraz. That's the nickname for the temporary migrant detention center in Florida's Everglades. The temporary camp is expected to house 5,000 migrants in tents on the sites of the Dade Collier Training and Transition Airport in Ochapee, Florida. Plans to build this facility have been met with fierce criticism from immigrant and advocacy groups. One group filed a federal lawsuit last week, and multiple groups participated in a protest over the weekend. Elise Bennett, an attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity in Florida, said the massive detention center would ruin one of the most, quote, iconic ecosystems in the world. Also, Thomas Kennedy, spokesman for the Florida Immigrant Coalition, said the detention center is, quote, not going to work, especially in the middle of the summer in the Everglades. It's actually quite cruel and inhumane, end quote. It's been reported that several migrants have died in ICE custody this year. New York State Assemblyman Zoran Mamdani has officially won New York City's Democratic mayoral primary. The Associated Press called the race after results showed that the 33-year-old beat former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo by 12 percentage points. Mamdani's win had been expected since he took a commanding lead after the polls closed a week ago, falling just short of the 50% of the vote needed to avoid another count under the city's ranked choice voting model. The system allows voters' other preferences to be counted if their top candidate falls out of the running. Mamdani will face a general election field that includes current mayor Eric Adams, in addition to a Republican candidate and independent candidate. In the D.C. area, there's a new fire chief in Prince George's County, Maryland. At a press conference yesterday, newly appointed county executive Aisha Braveboy announced that the new chief is Thelmetria Michaelides, who prefers her nickname Mimi. Ms. Michaelides is the second female fire chief in the county, taking over for Tiffany Green, who was the first ever female chief in the county. Green, who retired today, has become the assistant director of the county's Office of Public Safety. Mimi Michaelides is no stranger to the Prince George's County Fire Department. She started her career there as a dispatcher in 1987, and over the next 26 years, she served as an EMT and paramedic, and became the first woman in the county to be a certified bomb technician. She later retired in 2013 as a battalion commander. Mimi Michaelides says she wants to focus on recruitment and retention, as well as improving communication between career and volunteer firefighters. In today's weather, it's currently about 91 degrees in D.C. That's all for your headline news this hour. For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Darnia Samuels. Please be safe, and thank you for listening.